This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Tonight's topic is how to get along without going along. Before we go into that, I want to talk about something fairly briefly. And this was a short New York Times article just written a couple of days ago that one of my friends sent me. And my friend's been listening to this, and I've kind of seen this article kind of pop out in different viral feeds and Facebook and social media. And it's called
Teaching Men to Be Emotionally Honest.
It's written by Andrew Reiner. And of course, right away, this title just doesn't sit right with me. It really doesn't seem like you really can teach somebody to be something that they're not. And a couple of shows ago, we talked about, Dr. Lyle and I, we talked about the biological differences in different genders. And one of the differences, Dr. Lyle, that you mentioned is in how men express emotions. So the article starts off describing a YouTube video that went viral some time ago. Video was made by Jamar Collins, who took his son to get vaccinated. And as the boy is trying not to cry, his father's telling him, be a man, don't cry, who's the man, you're the man. So let's listen to this clip for a second, and you can hear what's going on.
Look at me. Big cheese. Big boy. Big boy. Be a man. Oh, big boy, don't cry. You got it, don't cry. Don't cry, be a man. Yes. Oh, big boy. High five. High five. Say you a man. I'm a man. I'm sorry, though. I'm still laughing.
It's okay. Hey, very sweet video.
Yeah.
Very cute for me to watch this boy bonding and learning from his father. But this video went viral, and of course, when that happens, out of the woodwork came people like the author, just yelling and screaming about how this is just representative of men's emotional suppression. In fact, this author quotes, the quote is, "The home video was right on point, illustrating that boys are taught to mutate their emotional suffering into anger. More immediately, it captured in profound concision the earliest stirrings of a male identity at war with itself." Now, I think this is utter and total crap. I mean, I don't see a father teaching his boy to turn his suffering to anger. It's actually a dad's masculine way of helping the boy deal with something he really has no control over, which is the pain from a shot. It's actually more empowering rather than crying about it being a victim, and he's actually teaching his boy how not to be a victim. So what do you think, Dr. Lyle?
Yeah, I think the author's obviously an idiot and doesn't know anything about developmental psychology. It's going to turn out that in a situation like that, I mean, we could talk at length about that, but we probably won't, that children are, and actually all humans, but this is particularly true of children, are designed by nature to actually use crying and whining as a manipulative tool to get support from adults. And so oftentimes, very good move if you're a parent that has a kid that does this a lot, what's happening is that you are actually facilitating that by being overly generous with time, energy, and support. And this isn't to say that we are cold to our children, but the point is that we can give them cues. Oftentimes, you have to understand that the crying, for example, and whining are manipulative tactics. Now, the child does not know that these are manipulative tactics. These are automated mechanisms built into them. So if you're a child in the Stone Age and you're confronted with something that looks like a predator, you should cry. And that cry is a critical mechanism to alert your parents that you're in serious danger. And so there's a reason why little kids cry. And they are designed by nature to cry a hell of a lot more than they need to, just on the off chance that parental support may be useful in statistically increasing their likelihood of survival. So it's going to turn out that most of the crying that takes place in the world today, actually in the sort of well-to-do world, has nothing to do with some child being hungry or in any way threatened by anything. They're inconvenienced and mildly irritated, or in this case, a little bit scared. And so for a parent to essentially signal to the child that there is no great danger, and the parent, by being relaxed and confident, chuckling a little bit, this is actually perfectly fine, and in no way doing any damage or shunting or repressing or any other wacky thing that this guy thinks is going on. This is great. This was a great example of excellent parenting.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because this is something that I think a lot of people hear, and I've certainly heard it when I was in college, and a lot of college students are constantly bombarded with this whole idea that all of our emotions are socialized and that we learn how to do something and that that's just how we are. It's because we were taught rather than ingrained in our DNA.
Yeah, that's insane. It's completely wrong. Our emotions are not taught at all. Our emotions are actually automated mechanisms as a result of deep value judgments that the organism makes in response to its environment. And they're critical signals to tell the person what is going on and what the nature of it, whether it's good for them or bad for them, and to what degree and in what way. So these are not, it is not possible to teach these. Your feelings are your feelings, and they are devices. And they are highly reactive to what's going on in the environment. So, for example, in the case of a kid who is frightened because he's in some pain, he essentially starts to signal to the parent that, hey, I could be in trouble. Now, if the parent signals back, no problem, you're not in trouble, this is actually reduces the kid's anxiety, and now he's fine, okay? So this doesn't change the way this child deals with the fear and pain and emotional upset and cause him to not have those feelings. That is utterly ludicrous. So a person, you know, who's thinking that just doesn't know anything about how psychology works.
And the fact that he was telling a man, and that's how not to cry about it on camera,
yeah.
This is just a way that males bond.
Actually, the truth is that it is true that it is advantageous for males to not be actually crying out to the village in helplessness looking for assistance, because it would reduce their status and it's going to reduce their mating potential. And so men by nature are made of a little bit of tougher stuff here than females are, and this is natural. So the fact that your dad may, in this case, the dad is made of tougher stuff than mom, and so the dad is not as upset by his kid's upsetness than mom might be in general. I didn't see this clip, but that would typically be the case. And because of the gender difference between the dad and the mom. And as a result, the dad's going to be a little less facilitating of this kind of emotional display of kids. And this is fine. This is no problem with this whatsoever. And this is just part of human nature that this plays out this way.
All right, okay, so now let's move on to the actual topic. I just wanted to talk about this because I've heard much from, we're in California, of course. People are slightly more open to new experience than, say, the guys living in, the Yukon Peninsula or something.
And right.
There's a lot of differences in opinion, and what I hear of is this whole nature versus nurture. But let's move on here. So last week, we had a great show talking about personality characteristics and how using the Big Five, the five-factor model, we can really start to understand personality more clearly. What you mentioned was that along with each of these personality traits comes a set of vulnerabilities where people can maybe exploited, and also a set of strengths. For instance, someone who's incredibly conscientious or on the higher conscientiousness will strive to get things done right. And the potential for this is to be overcommitted and overwhelmed. And way more often if they are also highly agreeable. Of course,
right.
If they're highly disagreeable, they'll be able to say no often, but they might burn some bridges in the process as well.
Right.
So with all that said, we're here to talk about things that we can get along with our peers and get along with our friends and family, workers, anybody else that's present in our life without necessarily going along with everything that everybody wants to do.
That's exactly right. And last week what we talked about was what I would call the sucker triad, and that is that if you're intelligent and you're conscientious and you're agreeable, you've got sucker written on your forehead, because you are one of the most valuable people that people are going to run into. Your intelligence is going to make you competent to deal with a lot of problems. Your conscientiousness will make it so that if it gets assigned to you, you will absolutely do a good job on it. And your agreeableness will make it so that other people will approach you and try to push you a little bit to get you to agree to it, because you are easier to get to agree than someone else. And so those three things are what I call the sucker triad. And that's a big handicap for people. But the way we get out of, or the way we manage the problem of having an agreeable personality, agreeable and conscientious personality, you don't necessarily have to be that smart to be really valuable in this way. If you are merely agreeable and conscientious, you are already in trouble in terms of social pressure going to burden your life with everybody else's needs. So what we need to do is we need to actually learn why it is that we are susceptible, and what this is about is it's going to be all about other people's anger. So if we ever say no to them, then they're going to be upset. And it is the agreeable person's inability to deal with other people's anger effectively that is the root of being a sucker. Now, this was recognized in the 1970s and gave rise to a genre of self-help called assertiveness training. And assertiveness training has, you know, it wouldn't be fair to characterize the whole thing. A classic book was written by Alberti and Emmons. It's called Your Perfect Right, and you know, sold millions of copies. And there's other best-selling books. When I Say No, I Feel Guilty. I'm Okay, You're Okay. There's been various and sundry works that have been written along the lines of how to be more assertive and to stand up for yourself. It's not easy to do for agreeable people, but we can talk about tonight actually specifically what people need to do in order to develop some skill in this area.
If we step back a little bit, I'm most curious, at the very beginning at least, why do we want to get along with each other so much?
Well, it's going to turn out that human action, coordinated action, is highly profitable. So they're simply running cost-benefit analysis on affiliating with each other. And so it's going to turn out that throughout the animal kingdom, you're going to see different kinds of creatures have different degrees of social affiliation with each other. And humans are going to be a very, very highly social creature. And the reason why creatures are social is because having other creatures around of the same species brings more benefit than it does cost genetically. And so it's going to turn out that people actually do some things more socially than other creatures. And one of the things that they do is they trade all kinds of favors. So I'm sure that we could get a primatologist that would tell us that other primates will do this. They will groom each other and pick the ticks out of each other's fur and so on and so forth. But they do not do the kind of things that human beings do. So human beings will go help a friend on a project for 2 hours, and then there will not be any direct expectation that there's going to be an immediate reciprocal process, that the 2 hours are owed. It's sort of a floating credit account that goes between the two individuals, and you're not going to see that kind of friendship with that magnitude of trading of energy in different places in the animal kingdom. So human beings are extraordinarily bonded as friends, whereas mostly you will see more significant trading of energy and risks in other animals only when they are kin. is winds up being very much a kinship phenomenon, but that is not true of people. People can develop really warm, loving, close friendships with non-related individuals, and it's because, partly because we are so capable of helping each other in ways that other animals are not. So, for example, if you're a Thompson's gazelle and you've got a buddy that you run alongside with on the savannah and you get your foot stuck at a snake hole and break it, there's nothing that your friend can do to help you. But as a human, they can. And so as a result of this, the utility of the help that people can bring to each other makes it enormously profitable to be helpful. So that's because if I'm helpful to you today, I might save you enormous time and energy today. And then a month from now, you may reciprocate on this very issue and save me enormous time and energy. So the reciprocity that's involved, if we thought about you and I living out in the woods and each of us breaking our legs every other year, we would see that 6 weeks of hustle that I would do to help you get you back up and running and surviving that process would be enormously beneficial to me, because it would be a credit account that I could tap into a year later when I break my leg. You can only develop this sort of reciprocity, friendship, floating process if you have along with it your coding for feelings and coding for cost-benefit analysis, and it turns out that it's very, very much in the black to be this way. So wolverines don't act this way, camels don't act this way, but humans do. And so this is, humans are a hyper-social species for the simple reason that they can do a lot and will do a lot to help each other, and it's enormously profitable to be social.
It reminds me of a video I watched with Milton Friedman, who's a long time ago an economist, and he was holding up a pencil, and he said, this is the only species in the world that can come together and mine the resources, collect all the resources there, and create pencil for as much as a quarter you can buy a pencil for. And you've got all these people working together to do this. And that's what the power of human human nature is.
Yes. Of course. It has become almost ridiculously successful now with a free market economy, as Friedman would have pointed out. But the roots of this were back in the Stone Age with very, very simple trades and a very simple trust, actually. And the trust is that if I help you today, you are likely to help me tomorrow if I call you on that for that assistance. And we both recognize that there's many things in this world that we're going to call four-handed jobs, where if you've ever been a carpenter or you've ever tried to hang a painting in your living room or something, if you ever tried to do anything that is essentially impossible to do it with two hands, but with four hands, it's very simple. Okay, it might be moving a picnic table from one end of your yard to the other, that you may not be able to do it by yourself, but with a second pair of hands, it becomes a trivial project. And as a result, human beings have many, many four-handed jobs that confronted them in evolution. And as a result, they developed an affinity for essentially, if I have a four-handed job that might take me 10 hours to do, but with your help, I can do it in 5 minutes. Then if I accept your help, I now owe you that 5 minutes, and you will carry that around in your head, and you will collect that 5 minutes at a time when it might save you 2 hours or 4 hours, or it might save you 10 hours. And as a result of having an oscillating situation where we are helping each other on this reciprocal basis, both of us are massively better off. And that is a huge root of human social behavior. In normal human relationships and human nature, there would be a fairly decent accounting system where people would sort of be keeping track of these oscillating processes, and there would obviously be some people that would be trying to take advantage of other people more often than the other way around. And so, and this is going to be the agreeable versus disagreeable dimension. And so you can see how you could be an agreeable person, and it would still be worth being in a relationship with a disagreeable person because, for example, on a desert island, there's still four-handed jobs. So let's suppose that that you and I live on a desert island and you've got four-handed jobs for your problems and I've got four-handed jobs for my problems. And you wind up exploiting me to this point that for every hour of help that I give you, you only give me 10 minutes of help. But it turns out that it's still overwhelmingly worth it to me to do that because you're the only person that I've got. And if I can get your extra hands to help me, that thing that takes 10 minutes would have taken me 10 hours. Now, the cost of it is to help you for 2 hours or an hour in order to get that 10 minutes. So your disagreeableness out-negotiates me, but it is still in my best interest to trade nonetheless. And so this is why it is that you have a range of personalities on this dimension, where most people are somewhere pretty close in the middle, what we call sort of 50-50 traders, real fair. And then there's going to be real sweet people that could be taken advantage of. Those are very agreeable people. And then there's going to be very, disagreeable people who are much more exploitative. And they exploit the people less agreeable to them by use of the threatening of anger. It's the displays of anger that are the ultimate threats that are being utilized there.
And are they actually angry, or I mean, is feeling unfair? I guess anger comes from that unfairness. It hinges on this concept of unfairness.
Right.
So disagreeable people will be much more angry more often than agreeable people.
Absolutely. So in contradiction to the idiot that was thinking that we learn our emotions that we were talking about earlier today, the truth of the matter is that emotions are highly specific to the circumstances in which elicit them. So, for example, if we were to take some ice cream and stick it into your knee, you wouldn't have any taste sensation. Yeah, it would have a very specific feeling, and that's what it would be. In the same way that if you tried to tell me, what does the color red sound like? It doesn't make any sense. It makes absolutely no sense at all.
You'd have to take a lot of mushrooms and LSD to understand that.
Well said, mate. Okay. So at any rate, it's going to turn out that anger doesn't just arise spontaneously out of the human nervous system or any animal without reason. The reasons are highly specific. Anger is a mechanism of signaling another organism that you have been treated unfairly by your perception. And so human beings only feel angry when they feel like something is unfair. So they might be feeling that it's unfair to some third party. That is possible. But almost all human anger is directed at whoever it is that whoever or whatever, in other words, what group of people, is essentially treating me unfairly. And so you can now imagine the following. If you think of the characteristics of people's agreeableness as falling in a bell curve, which it does. So you have people that we're going to put normal fairness right down the middle of this bell curve, right in the big fat part of the bell curve. And then as you go to the right side of it, as the bell curve tails off, we're going to call those very nice people. So let's say people in the 80th percentile or greater, in other words, in the 20% of the tail of the bell curve to the right, those people are very nice people. The people in the 20 percentile to the left, those people are very disagreeable people. And so those disagreeable people literally have a different perception about what is fair than agreeable people or super nice people. Normal people are nice people. So they are going to be angry much more often. They're going to be irritated, which is just another word for anger, except it's a word we use at a lower level. Annoyed might be another word. These are all just human beings using different, slightly different words to characterize degrees on a dimension. Furious and enraged are the same idea, except they're just further. I can't believe that psychologists like to parse these things out as if they're different phenomena. They are not, okay? Rage,
well, it depends.
Fury,
if your mom told you to be a man and not you to be a man, you know, it's maybe it's the toilet seat was
right.
Left up, you know, a little too long.
Right.
Yeah, they gave me
exactly.
Graham crackers as opposed to Oreos, so I learned all these
yes.
different emotions.
That's how you learn these things. That's right. So what we're going to find is that how angry people are is going to depend upon what the six seem to be and how unfairly they believe they've been treated. So you could see this, for example, in a sports fan who believes that his team has just been robbed of a Super Bowl victory by a referee. And as he watches the play, even on replay, he's infuriated because it appears the ref got it wrong. However, then he sees a second angle that he had not seen before, and he sees that the referee got the call right, that he sees his guy's got his hand on the other guy's face mask, and it's very clear there's been a foul. Okay, the anger will go away immediately. It will go away 90-plus percent, maybe 100%, in a matter of seconds. So this tells us that the anger is a highly specified emotion that is designed by nature to be activated when you feel like you or yours have been treated unfairly. And so therefore, people that are more disagreeable are simply having that emotion much, much more often because the anger has great utility. The anger is a threat to the people who are have some control over that resource, in this case, the referee. The anger is a threat to the referee that I feel like I've been treated unfairly and I'm going to impose costs on you if you continue to do this. And so when you say, kill the referee, what you are saying is you're saying, the cost that is, deserved there is death. And effectively screaming fans are threatening the referee. With their life. Now, what's very interesting in a very careful analysis of sports and refereeing and the home team advantage, this was very interesting. It was done in baseball, football, and basketball, all major sports in the United States. And this was a very, very detailed statistical analysis of fairness. Everybody tried to figure out why it is that home teams would have about a 62% or so chance of winning on average. Obviously, a very poor team in a league does not have a 62% chance of winning a home game. But on average, the average of, for example, in the National Basketball Association, the average home team should be, in principle, 50-50, but it is not. It is about 62% or so. So the question is why? And so they analyzed everything that they could figure out to analyze. For example, there's many theories that the team shoots better at home. Turns out to not be true. They don't shoot any better at home than they shoot away. There's also the idea that the backup players don't play as well on the road, but they shoot better at home. That turns out to be utterly false. The backup players don't shoot any better at home than they shoot when they're playing in other arenas. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, one grand theory after the next crashed on the rocks of the data analysis, and it turned out that what turned out to be the case was it was the referees. And so it turns out that the referees are completely fair except in the very final crucial moments of a game where there is the game is on the line and there's an ambiguous call, and then in that case, the home team will get an ambiguous call about 62% of the time. This is extraordinary. This is also true in football, and it's also true in baseball. And so it's because of the threat of violence against the referees. So the referees are absolutely know that under an ambiguous situation, if the call goes against the home team, they feel the outrage of 15,000 screaming maniacs in the stands, and their Stone Age brain does something to cover their life expectancy. And so what they do is they, more often than not, they lean into what's in the best interest of the screaming masses, and that is the cause of the home team advantage in professional sports.
So what you're saying is we cannot control this as much as we want, and that, you know, people are going to bend to the will of an extremely disagreeable force if the cost-benefit is sufficient. And in this case, the cost-benefit is I either die or I give them, you know, a game. So which one's which one's worth it?
Right, exactly. So nothing is more unpleasant to the, to a referee than a game that's going to come down to the last second. The that is, in fact, we just saw the national championship game between North Carolina and Villanova, and the referee more or less decided the game. And a Villanova kid got stuck in the key, and he was actually in trouble. He was very well defended, and he didn't know what he was going to do, so he turned and was going to put up a shot because he didn't have any choice. And there was a slight bit of contact. The North Carolina kid had defended him beautifully, called a foul. Okay, and so this is nobody wanted to see this game. A major, you know, it turned out there's more plays in the game, and there were some great plays. But that was actually a critical moment. There was a deciding moment in that game, and it was made by the referee. Now, in this case, the referee was not under the intimidation of any sort of home crowd. He was just trying to – he was facilitated and made the call, that he just felt momentarily compelled to make. But this sort of pressure is very much weighs on referees. And it's interesting that it doesn't matter how far away those fans are, whether it's a football field and they're a long ways away or a basketball stadium and they're right up close to you. You feel the pressure of all that human noise and human emotion, and you save your hide. It's exactly what people do. And this is exactly what nice people do when angry, irritable, selfish people put pressure on them. And so this is exactly the same process, where what the purpose of anger is to win concessions from people on the other side of transactions.
So in your practice, though, what are some of the most common instances of pushy behavior from others?
I see. I mean, it's going to be there's going to be a variety of situations. There's going to be there may be spouses where one spouse is most definitely the pushy one out of a pair. There could be situations where someone is dealing with a work situation, a work hierarchy, or a boss who is definitely being aggressive about, you know, taking a person's time and their life away from them. It could be a situation between parents and children. Parents, for example, are being very pushy about their children's performance in various sundry ways and putting a lot of pressure on them. So there's different ways that this can come about. And so I'm always looking for whether or not what I have is a pushy person exploiting a nice person. And if I do, then what I'm going to try to do is try to figure out how to even the score.
What are those tips and tricks that they can either even the score or kind of get along with people?
Yes.
But not necessarily go along with them.
What we have to do is we begin with understanding that our problem is the anger of the irritable person. So that person, that anger is actually very threatening. People are designed by nature to be intimidated by anger. And anger, what sits under anger is actually, what anger is a threat. And the most blatant threat of anger is actually the threat of violence. So when you have screaming fans, that is not a threat of, wow, we're going to complain to the league office about you, and we think you should lose your job. No, that is not what the guy is thinking or feeling when he's on the other end of an enraged stadium. He's thinking that his life is being threatened. So when a big, strong, or loud-voiced, very angry person raises their voice towards their wife or their child or their husband or their employee, when this is happening, make no mistake that what is happening is at the very Stone Age level. This is a subliminal violence threat, is what it is. It's useful to know that, because if you're on the other end of it, it's useful to be able to reconceptualize the fact that in the vast majority of cases, there is no real violence threat. It just feels like there might be. And you can sometimes get yourself a little distance in the situation and essentially reestablish a sense of your own options, because you are not actually being threatened with violence. You are feeling the threat of violence in someone else's anger. Now, the second thing to understand is that anger is the flip coin. If great romantic love feelings, the other side of it is enormous disappointment and shock and loneliness. In other words, those two things are being devastated. If those two things are sort of flip sides of each other, in the same way, anger's flip side is guilt. So it's going to turn out that the purpose of anger is actually to activate guilt circuits in the other person. So let's suppose we have an angry person and they're snarling, and what they're doing is they're threatening. Now, they may not even be threatening violence, but the threat that comes out of their mouths is essentially the threat of some other thing that values, that the person values. So, for example, if you're late one more time, I'm going to fire you. Okay, so you're not threatening violence there, you're threatening their job. Or if I see you look at another woman like that, I'm leaving you. Okay, so that's the threat of the termination of a relationship. Or if you don't get that homework done, you're grounded for the weekend. So this is the anger is signaling that the person means business and that they feel very much like they have been treated unfairly by the other party. So a parent that is yelling at the kid to get their homework done really feels like the kid is being unfair to the parent. The parent, after all, has great plans and goals for the child. The parent wants the child to accomplish big things, and the parent feels like they work really hard for them, et cetera. Or the parent is an egomaniac that is determined that their kid be some superstar, and they're pushing the kid along like a poor little puppet. And the parent feels very bent out of shape that the kid doesn't achieve, more spectacular things than the kid feels like achieving or could achieve. So in any way you look at it, what you have is anger on the one side, and the purpose of the anger is to win concessions from the other side. And first, the way those concessions get won is that the person on the other side feels guilty. So guilt is an emotion, again, that is not taught and not learned, for God's sakes. So our friend in New York that wrote that article is an idiot once again. guilt is a very...
Three times the charm.
Three times the charm. Yeah, in case anybody wants to check the logic of this, if emotions were learned, it would not be possible that everybody on Earth, including when we paddle up the Amazon basin and meet tribes that have never seen the outside world, it turns out that they have exactly the same characteristic emotions as everybody that's living in Chicago. And it turns out that they have the same emotions with the same facial expressions with exactly the same muscles that are firing in their face and around their eyes and around their jawbone. They have exactly the same paralinguistic cues with respect to what their voice sounds like under different emotions. They have a thing called laughter. They are not angry when they laugh, for God's sakes. In other words, and the very same social situations that give rise to those specific emotions are exactly the same social relational situations that take place in Chicago or Tokyo or Bangladesh. So the point is this is not possible that this is learned. These are universal features of human psychology, and so emotions are human universals. Now, the guilt is therefore not learnable. It is simply a device that tells you that somebody's angry at you, and you had better make a concession or they may impose a cost. Okay?
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What's the difference between guilt and then, like, Jewish guilt? Because there's a big difference that I feel when my mom gives me the, you know, Jewish guilt.
Yeah. It's actually not. You're feeling the sort of pushiness as your mom might signal to you, if we talk about parental guilt in this way. The parents can signal to the child that the child is not doing what the parent would have expected, and that the parent also feels like they have earned and is due them from the child. And so they are absolutely signaling that in order to gain concessions from the child. You need to be married and I need to have grandchildren. Okay, whatever. So the parent is
it's like
signaling.
You know me so well.
Yeah, exactly. So this is just the nature of a pushy individual that is trying to activate guilt circuits in the other person on the other side in order to gain concessions because they want what they want. So
this is a normal process for parents to go through, right?
Normal process. The more disagreeable the parents, the more acrimonious the situation is going to be within a household. So I've seen households where the genetics of everybody in the household were disagreeable and everybody's fighting all the time. And almost nobody ever feels guilty because everybody feels like they're being treated unfairly. So that's a spectacular comedy act that you will, if you're a therapist, you'll eventually see in your lifetime. Most of the time, you don't. Most of the time you see that one individual has sort of gained the upper hand on the moral high ground and is signaling very often that they feel like the person on the other side is not treating them fairly. The person on the other side will very often experience guilt and that they will be giving concessions. But the truth of the matter is, let's suppose we have a 70-30 trader, a very aggressive, pushy individual, and they are in a family with, let's suppose this guy marries a wife and the wife is a real sweetheart, so she's a 30-70 trader. And so the two of them are in fairly good equilibrium because the pushy guy takes advantage of the nice lady, you know, routinely. And she doesn't even feel that bad about it because she's a 30-70 trader. However, she has a son who's got a little bit of dad in him, but mostly mom. And so the kid is a 40-60 trader. So he's a very nice kid. He's willing to give up 60 to get 40. On most transactions. In other words, he's more than fair. He's treated as more than fair by friends and other students in his school and teachers. So he's very obvious to be seen that this is a very nice kid. However, his dad is irritated. His dad's irritated with him. The dad wants him to do things that the kid doesn't want to do. And so the dad is pushing with his aggression, and the kid feels guilty. But the kid feels guilty and makes concessions, but they don't stick. Because the dad wants 70-30 and the kid only wants to give up 40. He doesn't want to give up 70. The kid only wants to give up 60. And as a result, the kid then gets passive-aggressive and he actually doesn't come through with what the dad wants. He feels resentful. And then the dad, you know, recycles his aggression again. And this, you wind up with a constant recycling, anger, guilt, and then also sort of periodic rebellion. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to cut to what it is that people can do in order to help their weaknesses with respect to pushing back against pushy, disagreeable people. Pushy, disagreeable people, i.e. people, well, let's call them in the upper third of assertiveness with respect to, essentially anger. People that are more angry than the average bear more of the time. These people are going to have a strong tendency to be exploitative with respect to the other two-thirds of the distribution. So what do we need to do? When they push us to ask us to do things or they want things their way, particularly if they're coming after your time, which is a very big thing that people try to take from you, what you tell them is you wish you could, but you can't. So that needs to be the first words out of your mouth. So, okay, could you come and help me with this? Oh, I wish I could, but I can't. It's to be a reflex. That's just what you say. Now, what's going to happen is the disagreeable person is going to cross-examine you about why it is that you can't help them, because they feel completely justified that they need to take this 2 hours of your time or whatever it is, or 2 years. I've had incredible situations where a disagreeable person was in a relationship, a romantic relationship, with a very agreeable person. And the very agreeable person was extremely unhappy and wanted to leave the relationship. And the disagreeable person is basically like, no, like absolutely not. No, nobody's leaving anything. You know, we're in this forever. And apparently oblivious to the notion that an agreeable person could be pounded upon and guilted into staying in a relationship that they have no interest in being in. This sounds fantastical, perhaps, to some people listening, but the truth of the matter is these are real-life situations that happen with real-life people and sometimes essentially cost people their entire lives in terms of their happiness. So this is no small thing. But the basic template is as follows. I wish I could, but I can't. At which point the disagreeable person says, why not? And the answer is, there's something I have to do. And then they say, well, what is it that you have to do? And you say, because there's just something that I have to take care of. You say, well, what is it that you have to take care of? And you say, there's just something I have to deal with. Okay, well, what is it that you have to deal with? You say, well, I promised somebody something, and I just have to take care of it. Okay, you'll work it out. Now, the sequence looks like this. The disagreeable person wants you, the agreeable person, to tell them why it is that you can't do this. What other important value is essentially eclipsing their needs? If you tell them, hey, I've got to take my mother to the airport, then their answer is going to be, well, just hire a cab and have a cab take her to the airport because I need your help. Okay, that's what they're going to do. So this is why we do not give disagreeable people the reasons why we're doing things, because no reason is often sufficient. Now, obviously, if your mother just broke her leg and you're on your way to an ambulance with her, then you can say, gee, I wish I could, but I can't. Why? Because I'm in the ambulance with my mother. Okay? So, but most of the time, we don't have that kind of ammunition. And so as a result, when you just want to go home and relax and turn on the game, and you say, no, I can't help you. Wish I could, but I can't. Why? Because I just really feel like going home and relaxing and turning on the game. You are going to get their anger, and that anger is going to be very intimidating. So this is actually why very agreeable people turn out to do a lot of lying. And so, you know, if they're conscientious, it's a problem, because this gives them a lot of dissonance, because they're supposed to not lie and they're supposed to always do the right thing. But the problem is that their life is being taken away from them by pushy people. And so this is why I have this constructed in this way. I wish I could, but I can't. Why not? Because there's something I got to do. What is it that you have to do? Something I have to take care of. Well, what do you have to take care of? There's just something I got to deal with. Okay, so we say the same thing three different ways. Right through this thing, we spin it just slightly. Now, only a real pushy pain in the neck will continue to push. Like, well, what do you really have to do? Then you say, I just promised somebody something. I got to take care of it. Now, the reason we put the promise in there is because promise is a very important feature of human village life. That if you promise somebody something, it means there's a lot on the line for that other person on the other side of this transaction, and that you, as the person who made the promise, you have to come through. And so as a result of this, this gives you the moral high ground against any interloper of a pushy person who is going to insist on coming through here and breaking apart this deal. And so that's why we say that. I promised somebody something. Now, the person you promised was yourself. Promised yourself that you wouldn't let some pushy person run over the top of your life. Okay, so that's the promise you can make, and you can always make that promise. But you don't tell them that's who you promised. If they say, well, who'd you promise? You say, look, there's just something I got to take care of. You'll work it out. Okay? The phrase, you'll work it out, is essentially signaling to them that it's giving them esteem by saying, look, you can handle this. You don't need my help. Okay? And it's a way to essentially shut them down and close off the discussion. Do not try to solve the problem for them. Do not say, well, what is it that you have to do? Well, maybe you could get Susie so-and-so to do it. As soon as you open up that conversation, you have taken responsibility for the problem. Okay? Do not do this. Do not take any responsibility for their problem. If they say, well, how am I going to do it? You say, well, you'll work it out. Okay? This is how it is. This is how we deal with this problem. Go ahead, Nate.
Well, I was just thinking that each one of these questions seems to weed out the more and more suitable people and selects them out. So the maybe a 60-40 would ask you a pushy question once, but then they wouldn't ask you the second time, whereas a 70-30 would ask you the second time, an 80-20 would ask you the question, and then only the 90-10s and, you know, those really rare people would push even further.
That is ingenious. I never thought of that. That's a perfect way to put it. That the first question that you don't want is the 60-40. You feed that one back. If they come back the second time, you know you're dealing with at least a 70-30. You push back. Mm-hmm. If they come back you a third time, you know it's 80-20. The utility of thinking of it this way is that it should get your dander up, that they are increasingly out of line, okay, and that they are this is signaling to you just how totally unreasonable they are. Now, I have seen everything under the sun in 35 years of clinical practice. I've seen women in their 60s who couldn't go visit their sister because their pushy husband, you know, didn't want them to go. And I had to, you know, arrange and think through how it is that the social transactions would actually take place. What words would you say, and how is it that you would do it? And I remember one woman said, well, he wouldn't let me go. And I said, well, let me get this straight. Tell me specifically how he would stop you, okay? Would he stop you physically? Well, I don't think so. He says, well, in that case, then there's no way. So let's suppose you walked out into the street after you called the cab, and you're there at the cab. And she said, oh, he, you know, I couldn't go. He'd stop me. Well, how would that happen? Well, he would, you know, he might grab my suitcase, okay? So he grabs your suitcase. Now what? You're out in the middle of the street. Grabs your suitcase. You can go without your suitcase. You can buy everything else that you need. So you don't wrestle with the guy for the suitcase. If he takes it, he takes it. Okay? Hop into the cab. Well, in that case, he's going to have to be yelling and screaming, and he might actually grab you. Now, if he does, it will be very interesting to see if that happens. If he grabs you, don't pull away. Just stare at his arm. As he puts his arm on you, just stare at it. Just look at it, okay? Look at that arm for about 10 seconds, and then look at him. Do not struggle. And this, and what we're doing is we're going to embarrass him, okay? So this is how it is that we sometimes have to think through these transactions with very disagreeable people. Very often, the very agreeable person is extremely intimidated by the anger displays that have worked over and over again for a disagreeable person in their life, and they have not thought through how it is that they would actually put themselves in a position of power to defy them. And so this is, you know, this is a critical thing that we need to do to beat our genes, because the genes are absolutely going to fire and say, uh-oh, they're angry, we feel guilty, we need to concede. And agreeable people will very often sweep the hours and days and years of their lives right into the gutter if they do not figure out how to manage these problems.
This is for somebody that is maybe not as close of a friend as well, or maybe it is, because it seems to me that if someone has a very reasonable request, like, hey, you know, is it just my mom is dying and I need help, you know, moving something. Do we use strategy no matter what the request
is? No, in other words, no, the truth of the matter is that the it isn't that we're going to refuse everybody everything. The thing is that there are individuals that in our lives that very often, if you're a nice person, if you're in the middle of the bell curve or to the right, there are pushy people probably in your life. And those pushy people, whoever it is that they are using their anger to often manipulate you into giving up your time and energy to their desires rather than your own. And sometimes those things are a little bit out of whack, and sometimes they're a whole lot out of whack. We live in a swirling cauldron of credits and debits when it comes to time and energy between individuals and people that are close. This is all about when we know intuitively that that the balance sheet is not really right, that there's a person who is characteristically irritable, that they are often causing us to feel guilty with that anger. And when I say they are causing it, and people say, oh, no, you're the only one that can cause it. This is not true. The other person makes noises and facial expressions and uses words that activate spontaneously and without any volition of your own guilt chips inside your head. That's what they do.
It's almost like a trigger to a mousetrap.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is a trigger to a mousetrap. And so all what we need to do is, if you are a nice person who is more than fair, but you are spending your life often feeling guilty and manipulated by someone, then this is exactly the kind of techniques that you need to learn to take your life back.
Excellent. And you have more of these techniques and on your website, esteemdynamics.org, where you've got videos, some audio clips, and some general information. You can go on the website, esteemdynamics.org. You can have some consultations with Dr. Lyle as well with this regard. So this is a great topic. I think a lot of people benefit from this.
Very good. Good stuff. Good questions. And a very important area for human life satisfaction.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.